That's not so far from the States. About a two-hour flight from Florida, fly over Cuba, down to Jamaica. This is a little island, about 150 miles across, east to west. I think you could fit about a dozen of them space-wise into Wisconsin. And yet that's huge compared to where God took us for this last term, which was the island nation of Palau, the Republic of Palau. There was an urgent need there. My wife's uncle was serving over there as interim as a missionary over there, was home on deputation, but then found out he would not be returning and said, there's nobody to pastor here. And they were in their 70s. And he said, it's hard for me to take this 90 and 100 degree heat all the time. And we responded to the need there. So we flew from Minneapolis to Hawaii. That was a long flight, I think about 9 hours. And then from Hawaii across to Guam. And then that was about another 7.5 hours flight. And then made the connection to Palau, about another 2 hour flight. So not quite over to the Philippines. But it's a whole group of islands that's in this area right here. I know you can't see it well from there. You need a telescope and a magnifying glass to find it, but you can take a closer look at this later. Believe it or not, over in Palau right now, it's only about 7 degrees above the equator. Yeah, latitude. It's a little different from here. Over here, it's snow Palauan. But God has given us a new direction for our next missionary term, and for that we'll be spinning the globe. We'll stay at 7 degrees here and continue this way and come back to the Caribbean at 7 degrees above the equator to Guyana, which is between Venezuela and Suriname, north of Brazil. And so we're coming full circle. And thanks a lot. Just look at how inflation has affected the world. And that's one of the reasons we come back every 4 years to report. We certainly want to thank you for your prayers and your financial support. There's been 4 years of inflation, as you know, and we anticipate 4 more, so we always have a new budget to raise. And so that's part of the picture. But we're coming back full circle in more ways than just around the globe. My wife started out with her parents. They went on their first missionary assignment when my wife was 15 months old, and they went to Guyana. And now remember, it's Guyana, South America, as you could just see here. A lot of people say Guyana and they think Ghana in Africa. We're not going to Africa, we're going to South America, and it used to be British Guyana. And then in the 1960s, while my wife and her parents were serving there, the country gained its independence. And now, after they gained their independence, the leadership was basically a socialistic dictator that really closed down the nation to a lot of the outside world. And after a time, would no longer renew resident visas. So although the Gunthers, this David and Gladys Gunther, they had thought they might be staying there much longer, but God gave them 2 5-year missionary terms with a year back in the States doing what we're doing right now. And God really blessed their work. He accelerated the work. There were some other missionaries that worked with them, including the Kirstens, who are from this district. They started with Central Assembly, started with 25 people, and they were asked to take over this new work. And when they left, about 11 years later, they were running close to 1,000 people. And God really accelerated the work. They started a Bible school, and that Bible school continues to this day. And they had a radio program, a daily radio program. They did some nationwide crusades with people like C.M. Ward and Morris Cirillo And tens of thousands of people came, and so many responded, and God gave them great growth. And they really are a good example of what we try to do in missions with the Assemblies of God, and that is to raise up an indigenous church. We're not there to westernize them or Americanize them or just to do ministry for them, but to raise them up, to train up them up as workers for the kingdom and raise up a church that has its own local flavor and its own, that they take ownership of the work. And that worked so well in Guyana. And yet now in the 90s, some things changed a little bit. Doors have opened again. They started having open elections, and they started extending missionary visas. So in 1993, one missionary couple went there and has been serving there since then, Harold and Jackie Suggs. And they did a lot of work interior, evangelizing among the Amerindians, going south in the jungles towards Brazil and establishing a few different Bible school training points. And in the process, over the last several years, have built a beautiful Bible school building with the help of a lot of missions teams up on the Essequibo coast. And now Harold Suggs, you're going to see him in a little bit, a few quick pictures. But he's 72 years old, but he said, "I'm not retiring. I just want to go over towards the Suriname border and build another Bible school." And he's happy that we can come behind him and teach full-time there, where it's they have a few area pastors helping out, but their education is limited, and it's difficult for those that have the training in over in the capital city of Georgetown to make the major trip by road and by river to get over to that area. And so we're just real excited to be heading there for our new assignment. And before I show you an overview and pictures of both Palau and Guyana, I also want to tell a little bit about another missionary family that has gone on before us, and they served in Palau. They were there a little over 20 years ago. We're the second missionary family to go there. The first missionary family was asked to relocate to Fiji to teach in the Bible school there. So then they came, and we're only in country for about 9 weeks, and yet they've had a major impact on Palau. Their children were only with them for 3 of those weeks when they were brutally attacked one night. Late at night, 3 guys who were very drunk broke into their home and beat them, abused them, separated them, told them the other family members were dead. Their story was printed in the Evangel magazine about a year and a half ago called Terror in Paradise. And Daryl and Sherry Beebe, and I've been blessed to hear their testimony. Their story is so amazing. But one example of the torture that they endured is one of the men put a gun to the head of 12-year-old Jeremy, and they said, "We found this set of keys, this big key ring. We know you must have valuables in the garage, so show us which one is the garage key, and you better not play games with us. Show us the right key the first time, or we'll blow your brains out." And this kid had no idea what was the right key. But he picked out a key and gave it to them, and it worked. God was at work. Well, also another thing that happened was Daryl was hit. One of the guys swung a rifle like a baseball bat, bashing open his head. And he knew he was hurt bad, but he didn't know really how bad until about 12 hours later when he got some basic help over at the CB camp. And there he was able to see that his brain was literally exposed. It was that bad. And after they rescued his wife from an army bunker where she was abused through the night, they brought her in. They said, "You know, we really have minimal medical care here. You've got to get him to the States." And but they said, in all truth, they said, "He's only got about a 40% chance of survival," that we would say. "And if he survives, he'll just be a vegetable." Well, the next day she was able to see him off at the airport in Palau. They didn't have daily flights then like they do now. As she drove away, she was in tears thinking that she'd seen her husband alive for the last time. They couldn't fit Sherry and the kids on the plane. And they said the plane is fully booked and Daryl is a medical emergency, so we'll make room for him and a nurse. He'll need a nurse because with that wound, he'll certainly pass out and he'll need the help. Well, instead, the nurse passed out and he stayed conscious. But driving away from the airport, she thought she'd seen her husband alive for the last time. And as she was crying, little Jeremy said, "Don't cry, Mom. Jesus said Dad's going to be all right." Now she thought, that's sweet, but he really doesn't understand the scope of this. But indeed, he had seen a prophetic vision of Jesus standing there and saying, "Don't worry, your dad is going to be all right." And as Daryl flew to the Philippines and then later to Guam and then finally to Hawaii, he wrote a letter to his family thinking that this might be the last that he had seen of them. But finally he got to Hawaii about a day and a half later, got to the hospital, and finally he spoke up and said, "What's taking so long? Why is nothing happening here?" And they said, "Well, we've been studying these x-rays from Palau that show all of this damage. But the new CAT scan that we took doesn't show all of that." They said, "If you don't want us to fix that dent in your forehead, we can just stitch you up and you can eat." He said, "Stitch me and feed me. I'm hungry. I haven't eaten for 2.5 days. And that's exactly what happened. They put in a few stitches. And 24 hours later, he was driving to the airport to pick up his family. And he was in better shape than they were. We serve an amazing God. Now, each one of the family members had a long, difficult journey because of the trauma that they had suffered. But God brought them through wonderfully to complete healing, complete restoration through the process of forgiveness. And they tell people over and over again, forgiveness is not an event, it's a process. You'll think as something comes back to your mind, I still remember it, so maybe I didn't forgive them. Well, you have to say, "No, Satan, I have forgiven and I choose to stay in the process." And eventually God brings a complete healing. And we were so happy to be able to have them come to Palau and have some special meetings there for about a week and a half, and it was phenomenal. But let's show you some pictures now. From Palau. We have been happy to be Pacifically Yours in Palau. And this is sunrise from the northern end of the island where we lived. They have giant clamshells there, lionfish with poisonous spines, bat soup, and they love bat soup there. Got to taste some of that. Survivor TV show put Palau on the map, and here is the map, so you get another picture. Just to the west is the Philippine Sea, and to the east is all of the Pacific. And it's a whole group of 300-plus islands, as they count it. But the big one that we lived on is about the same size as Lake Winnebago. And you could fit all the rest of these tiny little islands, space-wise, inside that big one. And some of the most beautiful waters in the world. People only live on 6 of the islands. Here's the Beebe family as they were welcomed back to Palau. And they said, "When we come, it won't be to find closure. It will be for a victory lap." And it certainly was. Miracles of healing took place in the church and in the outdoor meetings that were held at the community college track and field. And it was just amazing. It went on radio and by internet across the world. Regina Remelik was first lady of Palau. Her husband was assassinated just into his second term in the 1980s. She began to delve into witchcraft to put curses on those who had killed her husband. In the meantime, she was invited to special meetings with the assemblies and got saved. And just sweet, sweet lady. There's the main church building. We thank God for the facilities there. One main church running about 100, but of course the real church consists of the people. And they do speak English and Palawan there, but that was one of the services in English. We had some Filipinos. We had an African family. We had a couple of Russian girls that came as prostitutes, married Palawans, got saved and filled with the Spirit. And so it was just wonderful to see what God did in their lives. Here's Milton. He became our assistant pastor as we welcomed him back after 3 years over in 1,000 miles away in Pohnpei. He got his Bible school diploma, married a girl from that island, and we made him assistant pastor and put him in charge of the outstation up here at Naralong, where some real good things were happening as we left. And there they did speak Palawan, and so we had to use an interpreter, except music works in any language. We had a weekly prison ministry in the city of Koror. Our church workers helped out with Sunday night preaching and communion and water baptism. Funerals were huge events, not dress-up events, as you can see, and as it was in Jamaica, but lots of superstition, lots of spiritism mixed in with the family practices there. But what a joy to see them find Christ and to be able to baptize them in the beautiful waters there in Palau by the Japan-Palau Friendship Bridge. Now, the lady in the yellow is great-grandmother to the girl in the blue on the left, both baptized the same day. That was fun. And that lady in the yellow said beforehand, she said, "Now what do I do with all of my potions and paraphernalia from this Palawan Morekne spiritism?" And Delight and some of the church ladies went over, helped her get rid of that. They had a big burning, and she was dancing in the joy of the Lord. Had a little radio station where we put out music, Christian music, 24/7. You might guess which one of those youth belongs to us. There's Micah, our youngest, with two of his best friends. Delight helped bring in Bibles, as well as she led the worship and played keyboard. I especially enjoyed teaching the Bible studies. Quick family update. Our oldest, Matthew, is 26, still single in Pensacola, Florida. And our daughter, Darla, is 24. She got married 3 years ago and to Phil Brown, graduated from Evangel College with a degree in art. And she and her husband are helping out at the Chinese Christian Church in Springfield. They've been studying Mandarin. Now they're helping lead worship in Mandarin and leading the youth there. Planning a trip to China, except we just found out now that she's pregnant, expecting around the 1st of September. And so we're going to become grandparents. Now Guyana is roughly the size of Minnesota, 760,000 people, which is 750,000 is a lot more than the 20,000 in Palau. And a lot of the Amerindians come from the interior up these river highways in these more isolated areas up to the mouth of the rivers where they empty into the Atlantic. And we had to take a 45-minute boat ride to get to the Essequibo coast where we are headed. I had opportunity to be there in October and minister in one of the churches in that area. And then to see the Bible school, where we're going to spend most of our time in training pastors and church workers there at Johanna Cecilia. There's a beautiful building built by a lot of missions teams that have come down and helped out. Here were some of the local pastors and executive leadership of Guyana that were gathered there for the dedication of a brand new building added to the campus there. And that's this next building is a teacher's dorm. So when they do come from Georgetown, that they do have a place to stay, or teachers that visit from America, I was able to meet the Bible school students and to speak to them, and that was a great thing, and to see the facilities, a little library that they had there, and some real decent classrooms that they have. And then they have a chapel area that they made sure they made it big enough so the area churches can use it, because there are all little churches around there. And this way the youth and women's ministries can meet and have rallies. There's Harold Suggs with one of the Guyanese girls. And now, I don't know if you can read the prices at the snack stand, run about $140 to $240. The dollar ratio is about 200 to 1. So it takes a pile of cash to do anything there. Now, we're not the only ones who have built a school there. You see, these pictures are of a Muslim school. And they had several buildings there, and they're teaching their kids 7 days a week there. And at that school, and the Muslims comprise about 10% of the total population of Guyana right now. And so here's a mosque that you see there, and it's fairly common there. But also along the Essequibo coast, you see, like, here's a sign about Krishna consciousness, the Dhamma temple. These Hindu temples are very predominant there, and you see domed prayer rooms in front of houses and businesses. 85% of the population in that area are Hindus. Our work is unfinished, like this last picture that you see here. The house is up on stilts because they have frequent flooding during the rainy season. As they are near the coast, and that land there, much of it is 5 or 6 feet below sea level. And we are excited that God is providing a place for us on the Essequibo coast, not far from the Bible school. And Harold Suggs told us that in that rapidly developing area, people are moving out from the big capital city and moving out there. The area was quite undeveloped before. They had very poor road and no electricity. Well, now, just in the last few years, they've got a good road on that 40-mile stretch between the major rivers, and they have steady electricity, and they even have internet now. And so a lot of people are moving out there. He said it's almost impossible to find any rental property. But he knew a young Christian businessman who had begun building that house that you just saw in the picture, began building that for his new home. And he said, you know, would you consider finishing the house and renting it to missionaries when they come next year? And he said, yeah, I can do that. I'd like to do that. And he named a reasonable price, and he said, I can do that, and I can have it finished. I was just in contact with him about a little over a week ago, and he said, everything's on track. I think I'll be finished in June. And so we are so excited that God is providing that place for us. And he has truly opened a wonderful door for ministry for us. Now, when we were in Palau, that was a wonderful opportunity as well. We enjoyed mostly pastoral work there. And although in some ways it was our best missionary term, in other ways it was definitely the hardest. And especially for Delight, as she ended up having some physical problems, several things that were happening to her at once, and our leadership said, you know, there's not much help here. You better take her stateside and sort things out and get things settled there. So we didn't like to leave the work, but we went, and our Asia-Pacific region has a missionary office in the state of Washington in the Seattle area, and they arranged things for us, connected us with Christian doctors, and a number of things that were so helpful to us. Now, we ended up having to make two trips stateside, and the thing was, the first time, finally it was determined Delight needed surgery, and after that, a few other medical issues that still required some medication, and she returned to Palau, and after a time, her prescriptions ran out, and one in particular that she was taking, they said, not only can we not renew this prescription, you are not supposed to have this in country. Over here, we consider that a controlled substance. And they said, we can give you this substitute. The doctor said, try this substitute. And she tried it for 2 days and had a severe reaction to it. And once again, our leadership said, you know, you've got to return and get this taken care of. So we did that. Now, all things don't happen for our good. And we believe that along with the spiritual warfare, Satan was attacking us in this way. But although all things don't happen for our good, God works them together for good. Through all of this now, Delight and I are stronger and more healthy spiritually and physically than ever before. We are closer as husband and wife. We are closer as a family. We thank God for that. Also, during the first trip back, I got a call from my dad who lives in Adams. It's north between Wisconsin Dells and Wisconsin Rapids. And he said that my mom was going to have quadruple bypass surgery and that it might happen right after Christmas. Well, we were home, we were stateside already at that time and didn't have appointments during that time between Christmas and New Year's. So he said, we'll come. And we got there and found that surgery was delayed a few weeks. In fact, mom ended up having surgery the same day as Delight. But if we'd been there at the time of surgery, she would have been so groggy and recovering and in the hospital all that time. I'm just thankful that we had that wonderful time with mom and dad. We never expected to have that in the middle of our term. And after that, mom came through the surgery well. And in fact, she and dad took a road trip with my aunt and uncle all the way down to El Paso, Texas to see my sister that summer and came back. But when we were stateside the second time, I got a call from my dad that told me that my mom had had a major stroke this time. And so again, I was able to respond and get home and had 3 days at the hospital at mom's bedside along with my sisters before the Lord took her home. And I'm so glad for that time that we had and to know that she has her complete healing now. She's with Jesus. But we're so thankful. I don't know how I could have ever have arranged for the visit the first time and to have that special time with my mom midterm and then to be there at the time of her homegoing and be there for the funeral. So you see how God works all things together for good. And we really depend on your prayers. We're so thankful for not only your financial support, but your prayer support. And that's the biggest benefit of us traveling around. When some people say furlough, some people think it's a year's vacation. Well, we visit about 100 churches in a year that we're back, and it's a very busy time, but we're so thankful, especially during the tough times, to know that somebody back home is praying for us. Back in the 1960s, when my wife's parents were in Guyana, her father, and some of you may know David and Gladys Gunther, I think this church had supported them in their missions ministry as well. Dave had gone to actually not real far from the area where we're going to be. He'd crossed the river by boat and held some special services and was involved in church planting along with all the other things they were doing and brought some Bible school students with him. And God blessed their ministry that night. They had some wonderful results. Things went on kind of late, and they got back to the river about 11 o'clock. They got to the river. They found that their boat was gone. Somebody had stolen their boat. So then they were trying to figure out how they were going to get across the Demerara River and talk to people. Finally found an old fisherman that was willing to take them across in his boat. There were seven of them that made the crossing. And after they got out there, they found how drunk this man was, weaving the boat back and forth. And all of a sudden, there's a big fishing trawler coming from the Atlantic, coming down the mouth of the river, didn't see this little boat that had seven people in it with no light. And instead of steering away from it, this drunk captain steered right into it. The boat hit the side where David Gunther was, immediately turned over. He didn't even have time to get a gulp of air before he went down. Turned over, of course, his trumpet went down, and his Bible, interestingly enough, his Bible washed ashore later, and he has that Bible yet today. And somebody found it and brought it to him. But when he went down, he came up, and instead of finding air, though, all he found was the bottom of the fishing trawler. And again, his air was supply was rapidly depleting. He went down, he came up again, on the bottom of the boat again. He could feel himself drifting towards unconsciousness. He thought this must be the end. He began to pray in his heart for the Lord to take care of his wife and family. Came up a third time, nothing but boat bottom again. And this time, almost passing out, he was being drawn towards a propeller. When he got next to the propeller stopped, And he came up right next to the propeller and got his breath of air, gasping for breath. And finally somebody threw him a life preserver, and he was already some distance from the boat, had to swim to the boat, and could barely make the climb up the rope to the ship. But he was the only one rescued out of the water. Two or three of them had swum to one of the shores of the river, and the others, including two Bible school students, drowned, and the boat captain drowned. Interestingly enough, through that incident and the contact that they had, the captain's son got saved and felt a call of God to the ministry. It seems that he picked up on a call to ministry, perhaps, that one of the Bible school students had. And he said, "Lord, I want to be a minister. I want to go to Bible school, but I don't know how to read." But he opened up his Bible, and God began to help him learn to read his Bible. And he went to Bible school. He graduated as valedictorian of his class. And today, pastors a great church up in Toronto. And God is so good. But also, there's another part to this story. A few years later, when the Gunthers were stateside, they met a lady that had written to our headquarters with a question. She said, "Is there a missionary David Gunther?" She said, "I don't know any missionary David Gunther. I know some missionaries, but I don't know him. But God woke me up in the middle of the night to pray for him, and I prayed until there was a release." They were able to compare notes and times, and it was the exact time of the boat accident that she began to pray, and she prayed until she felt the release as he came to safety. Praise God. Praise God. That's another reason we ask for prayer support. And if our name pops into your head, please pray for us. We appreciate your prayers so much. I'm going to be showing you some more pictures from Palau in just a few minutes. I'm going to be telling you something that's represented by this little round piece of stone. We call this stone money. Now, this looks kind of big for money, but actually this is a miniature. This is just a small replica that they sold at the museum bookstore to represent the stone money. You'll get to see how big it really was. And it's these big rounds of stone that people used to come from the island of Yap between Palau and Guam. They would take their boats down to Palau, hand carve out these great round rocks, and take them back to Yap. But because of the size and the heaviness, sometimes their narrow war canoes tipped over and people drowned trying to get them to Yap. But what was it they treasured? Why was it they treasured this rock, this kind of rock, so very much? We're going to talk about that. But before we take a look at those pictures and tell you more about that, I want to read from Matthew chapter 6, a short passage that I think that you are already familiar with. From Matthew chapter 6, beginning with verse 19. "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Jesus taught us that there's one good place that you can make an investment that will always be good, and that's to invest in the kingdom of God. We've had such a vivid illustration lately, haven't we, of how soon riches can be gone. But Jesus said it's not just your words that tell where your heart is. He said, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. It's what you invest in with your time, your effort, your energy, as well as your dollars. What you invest in, you put your heart into that. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. In Proverbs, we read that we should guard our heart because out of the heart comes the wellsprings of life. Of course, the Bible speaks of the heart so very much, and it's It's not just the emotional part like we think of around February 14th. And it's not just the spiritual part of it, us either, like sometimes we think as Christians. But it's the very core of our being. Our whole way of thinking, our decision making, our creativity, our attitudes, our relationships all flow out of the heart. And of course, all of this can put pressure on the physical heart. And it's no wonder that the writer said, guard your heart. And I want to challenge you with some thoughts tonight about where is your treasure and where is your heart. But let's go back to Palau. We'll show some more pictures here of the stone money of Yap. Sometimes it's called the stone money of Palau, but I call it the stone money of Yap because in Palau, it really had no value. Has no value in Palau other than the fact that they could sell this to me for about $7.50 at the museum bookstore. And they can tell this story about how the Yapis would come from their island to Palau. And yep, there really is an island called Yap. And we had opportunity shortly before we left Palau to take a little trip out to one of these rock islands where they used to come and cut out these rocks. And you'll see one great stone wheel that is there. Now, I used to wonder why it was that people would risk their lives to get these great rounds of stone. To this day, up in Yap, I've seen pictures of these big round stones on the side of the abai, where the chiefs meet, or along the side of a house where some of the more wealthy people are, and the bigger the stone and the more that they have of these, the wealthier they're considered to be because of the risk of life and the perceived value of it. Now, of course, back 100 years ago when they got this, they didn't have all the railings and things. Now, there is one huge one right there. Now, I don't know if any made it that size down to the boat. That one didn't make it to the boat. But as you can see, that's about 6 feet across, at least. And the big hole in the middle is not to make it look like a donut, but that they carved those holes in the middle so they could put a tree limb through it and carry it on their shoulders. Now you can imagine hand carving something that big out of these caves like this and rolling it down those narrow paths just to get it to the boat would be an awesome job. And to do all of this so carefully with the hand tools. Well, we found out from some other missionary friends a story behind the stone money that you don't ever get in the tourist brochures or at the museums or anything. And the story we learned explains the reason why the Yapis put their such attached value to these big stone wheels. And that was such a thick one there. Turns out that a couple of guys came down, you know, more than 100 years ago, down to Yap, and in their visit, they did something bad. I don't know what it was, but they got punished by being banished to one of the rock islands with no boat, no way off of the island. And so as they were sitting there for weeks with nothing to do, and a few months, I believe, went by before they were finally released, and they began to talk among themselves and say, what are we going to do to explain our long absence? We can't tell them it's because we were banished to this island. We were being punished. They'll punish us again. They'll kill us. We've got to save face. We have to save embarrassment. What can we do? And as they looked around, they saw that some of this rock, like this one, had some glitter in it, some chrysolite, and that some of it had fool's gold in it. They said, that's it. That looks shiny. That looks like something valuable in it. That's the story we'll give. And sure enough, they got back to Yap and they said, you know, the reason we took so long is we started hearing about this great treasure in Palau, the stone money. And here's a sample that we knocked out of the rock there. And just look at the sparkle. Look at how valuable that is. And they sold that story. They believed it. I guess they took for granted that they were telling the truth about the value in it. And they said, we've got to get some of that. We've got to get some more of that. And they began making boat trips over 150, 200 miles, whatever it is, from Yap down to Palau, carving out bigger and bigger round stones. And like I said, the bigger they got, the more difficult it was when they hit the choppy ocean waters, and many of them didn't make it. What a tragedy to risk their lives for something that had no real value. Well, as I think about that, though, are we that much different in our society? We can knock ourselves out and invest everything we have and end up with something that's about as valuable as this little piece of rock in the long run. If you had all the gold in the world, what's that going to be worth once we get to heaven? They're going to use that for pavement there. Well, we need to invest in the kingdom of God, and I believe like never before. That's the one place Jesus guaranteed us was the right place to invest. Now, one man that knew how to make a wholehearted commitment, you may have heard the name Jim Elliot. Back in the 1950s, he and his friends were murdered at the hands of the Alka Indians they were trying to reach. And the story is in Through Gates of Splendor and more recently The End of the Spear, the book and the movie. Before he died, Jim Elliot had written in his diary something like this. It said, "He is no fool to give that which he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose." Isn't that great? He is no fool to give that which he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose. Wow. Most of us aren't quite so good in our expressions, even though especially like at Valentine's Day, we try hard, don't we? I think of one girl that was testing her boyfriend's love. And she said, "Do you really love me? I know you've told me you love me, but would you be willing to do anything for me? Would you cross the widest ocean for me?" He said, "Oh yeah, baby, for you, I'd cross the widest ocean." She said, "Would you climb the highest mountain for me?" He said, "Oh yeah, baby, in a heartbeat, I'd climb the highest mountain for you." Then she said, "Would you die for me?" "No, mine is an undying love." Well, I know we try to tell the Lord how much we love Him, but I think sometimes He's looking back at us and saying, "Now, you think you could qualify that a little bit? In fact, where your treasure is, that's where your heart really is." And He knows, He understands that. Are we ready to lay down our lives? Are we ready to become a living sacrifice, which we are told is our reasonable service of worship? And, of course, they say the trouble with a living sacrifice is it keeps crawling off the altar. But that's why we need to keep coming back, don't we? And say, "Lord, here I am. I'm all yours. Everything I have is yours. I belong to you wholeheartedly, and I treasure you." And for many of us, it's difficult to make that commitment. And as far as commitment goes, I think of a story in Genesis 42 where Joseph's brothers, Jacob's sons, were trying to talk Jacob into letting them go down for a second trip to Egypt to get more food, because the famine was going on and they were running out of food. But they knew they couldn't return without Benjamin. Their father didn't want to risk losing Benjamin, as he thought that Joseph was totally lost. And finally, Reuben, the firstborn, stepped up and he said, "Father, if I don't return with Benjamin safe and sound, you can have my two boys." That didn't convince Jacob to release Benjamin and for them to go. But the next chapter, we read where Judah stepped up. He said, "Father, if I don't return with Benjamin safe and sound, you can have my life." There's a difference there, isn't there? between saying, you can have my two boys, or you can have my life. Are we ready to make that kind of commitment to the Lord? With some of us, I think our attitude, in spite of what our words may say, might be more accurately reflected by there's a book by Jill Briscoe. I think the title says it all. It says, "Here am I, send Aaron." Sometimes we're a little bit like Moses, aren't we? A little bit reluctant. Say, "Lord, send somebody else." But we need to be ready to make that wholehearted commitment and saying, "Lord, I'm yours. If you want to send me across the street, across the state, across the ocean, I'm yours. Everything I am, everything I have, I want to invest in you." Like Jesus talked about in Matthew 13, about the kingdom of heaven being like a man who found the pearl of great price and went and sold everything he had so he could buy that field, put everything into that treasure. That was a wholehearted commitment. And it's time that we ramp up our efforts and our commitment level as never before and tell our world that their wheel of fortune really isn't worth very much and that they need to trade in the wheel thing for the real thing. That's what missions is all about, whether it's home missions or world missions, is telling the world this basic message. And we thank you for your continued support and your prayer. And we ask that you would recommit yourself along with us to say, "Lord, whatever it takes to get this message out." And I want to close with a song that I wrote a few years back that expresses how we feel about this. We feel this will be our most important term yet. And we ask for your prayers because we feel that we have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. We know that you are called also for such a time as this. Got a little bit of Caribbean feel with this one. We've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. As a royal priesthood, we will rise and take a stand. We've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. We'll work and pray until we see revival in our land. We've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. As a royal priesthood, we will rise and take a stand. We've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. We'll work and pray until we see revival in our land. So many people in Guyana live in bondage. So many people in Guyana live in fear. And we've got to bring to them the gospel message, explaining it to make it clear. We've got to bring deliverance and set the captives free, teaching them to walk in the light and live in liberty. We've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. As a royal priesthood, we will rise and take a stand. We've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. We'll work and pray until we see revival in our land. the Holy Spirit, we must go now. We've got to work while it is still day, training workers for the harvest. We know we must not delay. Will you sacrifice the cost and time to plant some seed? We've got to multiply our efforts. Can you see the need? We've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. As a royal priesthood, we will rise and take a stand. We've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. We'll work and pray until we see revival in our land. Sing it with me, won't you? We've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. As a royal priesthood, we will rise and take a stand. We've come to the kingdom for such a time as this. We'll work and pray until we see revival in our land. We'll work and pray until we see revival in our land. We'll work and pray until we see revival in our land.